The speaker tonight is from the same area of the country that I grew up in. We didn't go to high school or anything together because he's a little younger. Okay, a lot younger, like everybody else is. But we met in Georgia through a mutual friend from New Jersey. And that's a true story, but I won't explain that further. We keep in contact. His story and his life has helped me a lot. He has helped keep me sober. He's a friend. I introduce Kenny P.
Thank you, Danny. My name is Kenny P. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm also a liar, thief, and everything else under the sun. But not today. Only through this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I belong to today. I don't do those things anymore. It's really a nice place you guys got here. First of all, I want to say this treatment center of Ridgeview and the alumni and the baseball game, softball game, the things you guys do together. I know it's important. Fellowship is important. Without that, when I came in, I probably would have walked right back out. In fact, I did walk back out. I was introduced to this program when I was in my early 20s, but I didn't stick around. I had to go out and do some more research. Research damn near killed me, but it was only through the grace of God that kept me alive to be here today. And hopefully, in listening to my story, maybe some of you will be able to identify some of the things in your lives that were prevalent in mine. Like Danny said, I moved down here 3 years ago from Detroit. I know Danny grew up in Michigan too. And it is through a mutual friend that that we met. And the circumstances, I'll get into that later on. But this mutual friend, my wife at the time and I were taking a cruise to Mexico in the Caribbean, and on the itinerary of the ship, we saw that there was, at 5 o'clock on a certain deck in a certain room, there was Friends of Bill W. meeting. So we said, sure, let's go to that, you know. Let's keep this alive, and even in our vacation. And chairing that meeting was this mutual friend of ours. And I don't believe in coincidences, but after that meeting, that evening for dinner, the captain pairs you off with another couple for a dinner partner to fill up tables for four. And this particular man and his wife were also our dinner partners for the whole trip, for the 7 days. And I thought that was rather coincidental, huh? But as it turned out, he also was a retired FBI official, agent. And given my background in history, which you'll hear in a minute, I graduated from the state pen in Michigan. I had a lot of years I put in there toward my PhD of criminology. And in sharing our stories at that dinner table on that cruise, I'll tell you what, we had a crowd, we had an audience every night coming around us. And just people at the next table, they'd stretch in their ears to listen to us because we were hooting it up, I'll tell you. And it was funny, and it was one of the best times of my life, you know. And I've had a lot of those in my recovery in these years that I've been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. I got clean in Narcotics Anonymous. When I went through a 30-day treatment center and I got out, that's where I felt comfortable. I was 37 years old. I was on parole. My parole officer dropped me off on the steps of the treatment center and gave me a choice to either go there once again or go back to the penitentiary, which didn't scare me at all. And that's scary because I've really felt at home. I was state raised. I did most of my adult life in the penitentiary in Michigan. One of the claims to fame of the penitentiary system in Michigan, it has the world's largest walled prison in Jackson, Michigan. I spent a lot of years in there behind those walls. Eventually, I always knew they would let me out. And I would look at those episodes as vacation times for me. And I'd always make these promises to myself that when I got out this time, things are going to be different. I'm not going to go back to that same crowd. I'm not going to go shoot heroin. I'm just going to smoke weed. I'm not going to go get a bag of weed and smoke every day. I'm just going to drink some beer and a little bit of wine and go to the doctor and get me some Valiums. You know, this was my best thinking. And that was my program, you know, over and over and over again. And obviously my program didn't work. I had to find a new program. When I went to the parole office, I was out for about 4 months before I went into that treatment center. And I had met a girl there that was on parole who eventually became my wife. And she had a car, and my neurosis looked across the waiting room at her neurosis, and we hooked up. She said, "You want to go have a cup of coffee?" I said, "Sure." She goes, "I'm an NA." I said, "Take me to it. I'll go there with you." And for 4 months, her and I dated, and against the knowledge of our parole officers, because it wasn't allowed. And then eventually I dropped a dirty urine, and I went into treatment, and she stayed out there in her addiction for a while longer. And when I began to let this program work in my life, in that 30-day treatment center, I started changing. And I started saying prayers that she would surrender and come in also. After the 30 days was up and I got out and I went into a three-quarter house where I could go out and work but live there. It was a safe environment for me, and I needed that because I had nobody left in Detroit that wanted me around. I have a small family. My sister and her husband were about the only ones left. A few aunts and uncles and cousins, but for the most part, this disease decimated my family of relatives and grandparents and my parents. It took them all. And I finally had a chance here to do something about it. And like I said, I was 37 years old, and for the first time in my life, I shut my mouth and started listening about a different program to use as a way of not going back to the penitentiary again. That's all I really wanted. I was just sick and tired of doing time, and I figured I didn't have one more bit left in me. And if it was, it was going to be the ultimate, and I would just die in there. And that wasn't too appealing to me. Never gave a thought while I was growing up and doing all this and of consequences of my actions. I mean, I knew that when you pull a stick up, the chances are, you know, if you get caught, you're going to the penitentiary. But, you know, I had that attitude, as most of us do, that happens to other people, not to me. I can get away with it, you know. And that was my attitude. I also had the attitude that society owed me something. The reason I had that attitude was because early in my life as a teenager, when I was 16, like I said, this disease, my father was a full-blown alcoholic, and at the age of 41, he fell over in the bedroom one day going through DTs early in the morning. I was a junior in high school. And he hit his head, put a gash in his forehead, and was bleeding. And as I knelt down and started mopping up the blood on his head with the corner of the blanket from the bedroom, and my mom ran into the bathroom to get a wet towel, he convulsed and died right there in my arms. Devastated. I mean, he was my dad. Didn't have a lot of good experiences, had some. We built a bike together. We played catch. He taught me a lot of the things a father and son do growing up. But also, I remember a lot of fights, you know. And for me to remember anything in my past is good, because the way I used out there, I guess you could term the term wet brain and dipshit and out of it. And I mean, those are all terms that could be described for me. I really had no clue. From one day to the next, they just went into one day, went into the next. But anyway, we buried my dad, and I don't remember that. By that time, I was shooting heroin, and a year and a half later, I was trying to make it through high school. By this time, I was a senior, and I had the ability or gift to not have to really study too hard. I would study like the night before a test and take it and pass it, and I'd keep getting passed. I never got held back a grade or anything. I would put forth just enough effort to get by. But about a year and a half after that, my mom had caught me shooting dope at midnight in our house. I thought I locked the bathroom door, and she walked in on me and found me sitting there drooling with a spike hanging out of my arm, and she freaked. Needless to say, she kicked me out of the house. I walked around, and it was February or January, late January, in Detroit. Snow was deep, and I left, grabbed a coat and left, and walked all night long. When I came home the next morning, I knew she had to go to work. My grandfather was staying with us, and he was blind through a cataract operation, and I made Gramp something to eat, and then I went to school. And it was a time when we were taking tests, and I went to school, did my exams, came home, made Gramp something to eat, and waited for her to get home at 3:30 and face the music. She didn't come home, and for that I was relieved. My sister, I got a five years older than me. She was in the hospital at this time having her first child. She had been married for a year. She was 21, and it would have been a happy time in our house had it not been for me and all this drama I brought to the house. So the next morning I got up and made breakfast for Gramps and went to school again. And while I was at school taking these tests, I was daydreaming, staring out the window. And I remember having a dream the night before, but I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember seeing our garage door. It was green and white striped, and this popped into my head. And I had this urge to just leave class and go home. And I did, and I went home. And when I opened up the garage door, my mom's car was in there, and she was laying in the front seat dead of asphyxiation. She had left the car running, and carbon monoxide poisoning took her. And there was my mom was not a drinker, but she was going to the doctor to get her nerve pills, Valiums and barbiturates. And through an overdose of those and the booze that she had in the car and the carbon monoxide, she fell asleep and killed herself. Whether it was intentional or not, I don't know, but I figured it was. I mean, I blamed Ken. I mean, I might as well have put a gun to her head and pulled the trigger. So for the next 23 years, that's what I did. I tried to kill Ken, you know, because I was worthless. I just could not face that stuff. So it's funny, when I did my fourth step, after about 3.5 years into recovery, I was talking with my sister, making amends, and telling her about this story, because she had never known it. And she was amazed because at the hospital, she said that she was in a semi-private room and she was complaining to the woman next to her that her own mother, the child's, you know, my nephew's grandmother, didn't even show up to see his birth. And my sister was hurt by it, deeply hurt. And but my sister said she had had an epidural or whatever. She was kind of groggy. She said out of the corner of her eye, she thought she saw somebody stick their head in the door of the hospital room and then back out after they had listened to her complain about her mother. So she thought that was mom. And then the next thing you know, my sister, you know, gets the news that mom is dead. She has this baby, and then mom is dead. And she thought, she blamed herself that she had pushed my mom over the edge by saying all those bad things about her and my mom overhearing them. 23 years, my sister had that secret and kept it. It's amazing what we do to ourselves. Part of my healing was to write my mom a letter. A lot of my healing was to forgive myself and know that my higher power has forgiven me for that too. We all got a lot of bad things, you know, some real bad, some not so bad, but for us, no matter what, it's what keeps us away from that spirituality, that love, that humanity that we all need to feel to be connected. And so for me, being in the penitentiary all those years, that was right where I needed to be. It was like an animal existence, and that's what I feel I deserved. And I survived in there. I survived real well. I had to learn how to fight. I didn't know how to fight when I got there. I was 17 years old, and I was scared, you know, as most of everyone was. But I found out how to survive in there. You just yell the loudest, act the craziest, go up to the biggest guy and slap him first. I thought, this kid's crazy, you know. And, I mean, I did things like that. And I got the scars to prove it. And I heard somebody say the other day that our scars are reminders that the past was real. And we need not to forget them. We need not to shut the door, you know, but we don't need to dwell on them either. And that's a pretty good saying, good advice, you know, I recommend that. We don't need to forget where we came from, and I don't every day. And that's why I have so much gratitude for this program and you people, for the life I have today, because I got a life second to none. I just celebrated 4 years of divorce. I hear guys get up here and say, oh, I just celebrated 38 years of marriage. Hey, that's great, you know. I love it. What's wrong with a guy celebrating 4 years of divorce, huh? Sometimes it's good to be alone. I spent a lot of time alone, you know, and I didn't want to. Part of getting to know me and who Ken was getting to know what my sicknesses were, what all was part of my disease. And when I came out and got married to that woman that I met at the parole office, that was just pure disease. And we stuck it out. We knew each other for 10 years, and we were married for 7 and a half. And we got divorced 4 years ago. It's all how you look at it. I had a 7-year successful marriage. You know, and it ended. My very first marriage, I was able to produce a child in between on one of my vacations from jail. And that marriage lasted 10 months. And the girl was a lot younger. Sort of like a shotgun wedding. When Stosh found out that his baby girl was pregnant, he said, y'all are getting married. I was 29 and she was 17. Yeah. And just barely slipped in from going to jail for that one by a few days. But I celebrate being a father for 21 years now, you know. I got a beautiful, gorgeous son that's in the military. And 9 days from now, he's shipping out to Kuwait. And, my prayers are with him. I know I've done the best I could of letting him know that there is a higher power, and that when he feels the need, you know, to talk to that higher power, and he'll get strength from it, just as I have. You know, I've come around here for the last year since I've known Danny. And Danny's been a blessing in my life. I can't begin to tell you. Probably you already know, but thank you for sharing him with me. And he lets me come up here once a month, you know, for the Friday meeting. But, you know, he doesn't want me to move up here yet. But I'm sneaking in closer. I finally got a job nearby on sort of this side of town. Around Buckhead I'm working. I'm driving a tow truck. I'm towing cars, and we take them to the Atlanta police impound yard. So I'm working for the cops now. I mean, my whole life, just like a big revolving door, you know. Stick around a while, you know. You'll see some weird things happen in your life. You know, my dad drove a truck. And when I was a kid, when I was 9 and 10, I'd go on the truck with him. We'd pick up parts at the Ford plant and take them someplace else, you know. And then he drove a tow truck, too, on weekends as a part-time job. Because he put me and my sister and my mom, both of them put us through parochial schools. And you had to have a few bucks to do that back then. And it was a sacrifice, you know, and I realize that today. They did the best they could with what they had. Their marriage wasn't perfect, and they tried. And I look back now, and I see the things that my grandparents did, and that's how they were raised to look at things. A lot of it was old world stuff from Europe. I come from a Polish and Russian background, and it's true. The Polacks are not real fast at a lot of things. You know, it takes us time to learn things. But we're a loyal, proud people. Give you the shirt off our back, and if you're willing, if you're that type to help yourself, you know, we'll help you and go to any lengths to do it too. That's how my family was. Times of crisis, my uncles would be there dragging my dad to an AA meeting at my mom's insistence. And I could just remember seeing my dad sitting there with that bottom lip puffed out, you know, didn't want to be here. And, you know, those kinds of images, I remember I played Little League Baseball, and my team, when I was like 10 or 11, won the Detroit City Championships, and I was pretty proud, and I had this trophy, the first trophy I ever won. And my dad was in the hospital called Glen Eden, drying out. He had DTs. He had been there about 30 days, so he was looking good, and got a little colored back to his face, a little food on him, because he was skinny as hell. When he drank, he didn't eat. How he did all the things he did, drive a truck, drunk every day, because he used to keep that pint of whiskey, you know, on him all the time. And I remember the fights and my mom going around finding him all over the house, hidden and dumping him, and things like that. I told him one day, I said, me and my sister are going to get black and white shirts like referees and whistles, you know, and say, all right, Dodge, you in that corner, Irene, you in that corner, when the whistle, come out fighting, you know. And it's how my sister and I had to get between them a lot of times and stop this insanity, the fights, the hair pulling, lamps busted over his head, fists through plate glass windows, you know. Nobody else on the block had a couch through their picture window out on the front yard. We did, you know. It's kind of embarrassing. You know, cops knew who we were. Domestic violence was a part of my growing up. It's okay to look back at it now and make a joke and laugh, but at the time I was terrorized as a kid, you know. But anyway, I remember this trophy, you know, and I wanted to show them, and they wouldn't let me in because I was too young. So he was on a first floor room, and I was able to go around the back in the parking lot and talk to him through the windowsill and show it to him, you know, got the window open. And things like that, you know, they're marked in my memory, you know. There were good times, even though through the bad. And sometimes you got to sift through them, you know. I hear speakers that I've come to hear over here, especially over this past year, that are real eloquent, and they know how to tell a story. And one thing follows another. I'm nothing like that. I guess you already know that. I'm all over the page and everything, but this is my technique, you know, because everybody gets a little nervous up here. But I've also always been a ham. You know, I had to learn that in the penitentiary. I had to learn how to get along with people, or I was through. You know, you cannot be an isolator and a loner in there, or your days are numbered. I hear the word click a lot, you know, and I see people hook up, and we do that here. You know, and the thing to watch out for in here is that it's a healthy thing. You know, it can be a negative thing. I've seen people getting clicks, negative clicks, that take their ass back out there, you know, to use again. It's real recognizable to those who are in healthy clicks, you know, and if somebody tries to pull your coat about something, don't get angry or mad. If you do, it's usually the truth, you know. That's my experience since I've been in the program. When I get mad or angry about somebody telling me something that they think I'm doing, it's usually the truth. And Lord knows I've done everything wrong 100 times before I've done it right in here. Because I'm one of those that try, you know. I have to test the system, you know. I have to make sure it's right. I have to believe it in my heart before I believe you. I just don't operate on blind faith. It's taken me a long time to get where I'm at, you know, because of the years of mistrust, and I could not trust or turn my back on anybody. A lot of the things that I do today, I got a girlfriend. We go out to dinner, just for example, and I'll be done with my dinner an hour before she is. And she goes, do I eat too slow or do you wolf your shit down, you know? And I says, yeah, I guess I do kind of inhale it, you know. But I said, I remember at the cafeteria at Jackson, you stay hungry in a penitentiary, first of all. You only get three meals of like these little soybean patties shaped like pork chops. They try to fool you. And nothing like a pork chop. And to this day, I don't eat pancakes. I hate pancakes, but had a lot of them. Don't get me started on grits. But we had to eat fast because a fight might break out and you have to leave, you know, and you didn't get to eat. One of the advantages, too, is also, you know, when you're in a cell block with 500 other guys and showers are right after mealtime, you want to get in there and get out before all that scum is left there and you got to stand and wallow in it, you know, or wait and turn with the towel over your neck. In a place where guys haven't had sex in a long time and you're standing there butt naked waiting for your turn to shower, you know. It's not a comfortable place to be in, so you want to get in and get out, you know. And that's how I learned how to do all that stuff, you know. My M.O. was hit and run, man. Sneak in and get out, you know, before anybody even knew you were there. When I first started my life of crime, I first started driving the getaway car with my buddies for stick-ups. That was my first lesson in learning not to pull a crime with anybody else. Do not have a rat partner because they will tell on you. I did not get caught. They did and dropped a dime on me. Nowadays, I tell on myself. So I'm a lot... You know, I can deal with that rather than you telling on me. So, but that first time I went to the penitentiary, I was 17, scared to death. I got out when I was 21. And when I got out, you couldn't tell me anything. I mean, I stayed in the yard. I beefed up. All I did was lift weights. I finished that last half a semester of high school while I was in there. I got my better than a GED. I got a graduation certificate from my hometown high school. And my parents were dead, and I thought I had all the life experience that a person my age could possibly have, you know. And I came out with the attitude that I'm going to turn this world upside down. You know, this freaking place owes me something out here. And when I started to get all these doors shut in my face, you know, it's 4 years later, and I go to the lawyer that I had, and I said, you said you'd get me a job. Well, he did. He got me a job in a beer warehouse. I had to get up. I was in a halfway house on the west side of Detroit. I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, take a bus downtown, get there by 5, catch the suburban bus out to the Mount Clemens, which was 20 miles away from Detroit, north of it, get off the bus there at 6:30, and walk a mile to get to the beer warehouse by 7 and punch in. And get off at 3:30 and do the same thing. Get home that evening, take a shower, eat, and go to bed, and wake up at 3. That was my life, you know. Did that for a while because I didn't want to go back to the penitentiary. I was 21. What I really wanted to do was go back to school. My mom had this dream for me to be a doctor. And here I was. Well, I kind of blew that with the felony record now. But I would have been good at it because I shot dope like nobody else shot dope. I could use a syringe, and in fact, I even think I was addicted to the syringes. I even shot whiskey. That's how much I like syringes. And it's a part of my story I never told before. I shot acid, you know. Talk about immediate hallucinations. I mean, these things, you know, they get in your system, and it takes a while for the bloodstream to get them through. When you intravenously use anything, it's there, bam, automatic. And before I could even pull that out, I was tripping. Same with the whiskey. Before I could pull it out, I was puking. And that's what whiskey did to me. I hated this shit, you know. I mean, that was the first, my first experience drinking was getting my dad's Fleshman's whiskey and snorting that right out of the bottle, you know, and it burned. Oh, I remember, I can never forget. And it hit the bottom of my stomach and it would explode and then everything would come up, you know. And then I go, okay, I'm ready for another one now, you know. I mean, this disease causes you to be insane, man. There's just no telling about it. You know, when I got clean in NA and I said, the reason I came to AA, I had a sponsor that, one of the things I do is go back to the penitentiary and hospitals and institutions and tell my story. You know, I try to give back what was given to me, this gift of recovery that I have, gift of life. And them guys, the old-timers that used to go to the penitentiary, they go, man, we need you, Kenny. You need to come in, because them guys, they don't relate to us, you know. We drove around drunk a little bit, you know. We never been to jail. Might have done a day or a night in jail. Just your story, you know. You gotta go in there and tell them that the lie's dead. They can get out and be productive members of society like you are, you know. Just don't drink, okay? So I say, okay. So, you know, that's a big part of my recovery is going into the I went back to Jackson. And this is a funny story. Less than just about a year later, after I got clean, and some of the guys that I knew were still in there. And when I came in at 6:30 in the evening, the middle Wednesday of every month, that first time I went in there, my nickname in there was Polak. And a lot of these guys, hey Polak, what are you doing back? I says, yeah, I'm back, man. When you getting out? I said, about 8:30. They're flipping calendars. I'm looking at my watch. No feeling in the world like it, I'll tell you. I love what this program has given me. It's given me a life second to none, like I said. Let's see, what else? Hit me with a rubber band, Danny. I told you, if I get stuck, plunk me. Detroit River story? Okay. After that incident or episode or doing my time with the stick-ups, I thought, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. That sent me to jail. So while I was in jail for those 4 years, I learned how to crack safes from some good, pretty good safe. Well, not good. They're real good. They were in there. But... But they told me how to do it, so I thought, what the hell? So I started going around to businesses and collecting their safes and bringing them home. And about the best story I got there is that I worked one day, got this safe like 4 or 5 in the morning and bring it home. And I worked on it till about 10 o'clock, man, trying to punch them pins out of the hinges and everything and pry that sucker. Throwing firecrackers at it. I'm just praying for it to open, says me, rubbing a genie. You know, I'm doing everything to get this damn thing open. And finally, Komsky, this other Polak I was with, he said, what's that on the bottom of the safe? It's one of them punch things, you know. It had the combination to it on the bottom of the damn safe. Like I said, us Polaks ain't real bright. I went back to the penitentiary for another bit. When I got out the next time, I knew I didn't want to pick up a gun, but I knew that was the fastest way to make money. You know, just before I came here, I stopped at the Bank of America down South Cobb Parkway, and I got a little plastic card in my wallet where I can go in there and I can get money. It sure beats a note like I used to have to do. After you get money out that way, you got to drive your car real fast. You got to go the wrong way down the freeway, zigzag and everything. You think you're Johnny NASCAR or somebody. But I did pick up the gun again. My addiction was full-blown. I was shooting a lot of dope, and I needed big money. So I figured the best way to do it, rather than robbing these stores and gas stations and convenience stores, 7-Elevens and stuff, is just to go straight to the source and go rob the dope man, you know. Cut out the middle man there. Maybe the cops wouldn't be so mad, you know, if I'm robbing the dope man. But the dope man got mad. Ooh. At a bar I used to frequent called the Conger Bar in Hamtramck. Hamtramck's a little two-mile city inside the city of Detroit. There's another little city inside Detroit called Highland Park. Cops don't go there. It's a good place to hide. And I was in Conger Bar one night, and I went back in the back to go to the bathroom, and when I came out, these guys bum-rushed me and brought me out in the alley. All I remember was being hit with baseball bats and being stomped by cowboy boots and duct-taped with my hands behind my back, rolled up in a carpet, thrown in a trunk, and we went for a ride. And I said, this ain't good. This can't end up good. But I remember somebody had some kind of knife or a pick or a screwdriver maybe or something like that, and they kept trying to stab me and had a hard time. I felt the blows. I had bruises on me from it, but I didn't actually get any puncture wounds. And all this time I was doing my best to get my hands out of this duct tape around my wrist. And I did, just about the time that they rolled me off the Ambassador Bridge, and not the Ambassador, but the MacArthur Bridge into the Detroit River. And I don't know how to swim, but I learned that night real good. No great loss for me to leave Michigan. I think after that I left, and I thought geographical change, that would do me good. I didn't leave Michigan. I couldn't get far enough away. That was about the time that I got this girl pregnant, a 17-year-old, and we moved a few towns away. And I started to get clean. But I eventually found myself driving all the way back there to get some dope and coming back and just playing that game, you know, lying to everybody. I'm not high, as I nodded out into my plate of food or whatever. It just never worked. My plan just never worked, you know. Like I said, as I progressed, as my criminal life progressed, I started doing smaller, easier, sneakier things. I put the guns down. I didn't want to die, but I just wanted to. I was an addict. I didn't know how to get out of this revolving door I was in. I was reduced to begging. Panhandling. I remember standing at a gas station on Shaner and 7 Mile in Detroit on Christmas Eve in a blinding snowstorm asking people for a little bit of change. And as soon as I got $12 up, that's where I went to the dope house and got me a bag of dope and sat in some abandoned house, you know, in an alley, feeling sorry for myself, feeling like I got over again, you know. When everyone else was home opening presents and going to church and getting Christmas dinner ready. Those are beautiful things that I enjoy today. I love that time of year now. I have, every day is a celebration for me. You know, as you can tell from the life I led, I have a lot of gratitude for being where I am today. It's one day at a time. It's staying connected. It's getting phone numbers. It's staying humble. I don't ever think that I'm that big, that I can say no to anything that anybody asks me to do here. I got a job, that was another thing about working. I got a job with a company in Detroit that my dad used to work at. I remember saying when I was in jail, I'd never be like my dad. You know, and I ended up being just like him, except I'm a little bit old, 10 years older than he was. I was born in 1952. I'll be 51, with the grace of God, my next birthday. But when I got this job 6.5 years ago at this place in Detroit, it was a good job. It was an ad in the paper. The plant manager liked me because of the car I drove. I drove a foreign car, and he had one. And I said, but I got a bad record. Nah, don't worry about that. Everybody in here has been to jail, you know. It's like one of them places that you go. Like I was just telling Danny, I watched that movie 8 Mile with Eminem in it the other day, and I stayed at that trailer park he was in, and I did work at that bumper place, you know, shoving out truck bumpers that his future stepdad told him only junkies and convicts get jobs there, you know. And it's just, I don't know how we find them places, but I got this job picking up pans from the bakery industry. And I had never worked anywhere for 6 months straight at one place. I could never see the percentage of working 5 days if I only needed 3 days' pay to get high with, you know. Just didn't make sense to me. That was my Pollock arithmetic. And like I said, I had that attitude that if I lost this job or if I quit, I'd get another one, you know. It was just that easy. And somehow, a lot of times, that's how it seemed to be for me. It was like I had a guardian angel on my shoulder just looking out for me, keeping me alive at every turn. Just like that incident in the river, I got out of that and stayed away from that neighborhood and them guys, you know. And that wasn't the only time something like that happened to me. It was several. That's the one that sticks out in my mind the most, the one I was most scared of, though, that close to dying. But anyway, this company closed its plant in Detroit 3 years ago, and they offered me to relocate either to Ohio or Atlanta here. And I said, well, after I got divorced, I bought a bike, got rid of the hog and bought a Harley. It's a joke. Oh, no, I got rid of the pig and bought a hog. That's what it, oh, I'm only kidding. Wow, yeah. Bad joke, no. I love my ex-wife dearly. I wish her the best. Changed her mind about that phone number she wanted, huh? Anyway, I'm glad I made the choice of coming to Atlanta. I like Georgia. I don't like your kudzu. I don't like the fact that you can't get a bowl of oatmeal here. It's grits. Looks just like oatmeal. Shut up and eat it, you know. I love you real Georgians. There's a lot of transplanted people here. I'm one of them damn Yankees, like y'all call. I'm proud of it. But I'm here to stay. You know, when I moved down here, I told everybody up there, I says, I'll have them all speaking the Queen's English within a month. Y'all hear what I said? Y'all hear me? But if there's anybody new in recovery in here tonight, please keep coming back. Please stay. You just don't know what's in store for you. And don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. You'll experience a life and people that are the best on earth, in a life second to none, as I have. I'm sure you will. This was the attraction to me when I got out of the penitentiary that fifth time. I saw a guy that I had done stick-ups with. His nickname was Butcher. We had done time in the penitentiary together. And he pulled up in a Chevy Beretta or something like that on the 4th of July. And it was my first night out of the penitentiary, and I had just finished a fifth of vodka, and I was standing in the Clinton River trying to put a rock on my chest to drown myself. I kept floating back up to the top. I couldn't stay down. Like I said, I don't know how to swim. I don't know how to float. But that's why the Great Lakes steak, you know, they can have it. I don't need all them lakes. I like dry land under me. But I seen him, and he said, go clean yourself up and come on with us. We're going to a picnic, a 4th of July picnic. I said, cool, I'm going to get high, you know. And we went to an AA picnic, and there were garbage cans filled with ice and Pepsis and Cokes and all kind of pop, and people playing volleyball and pitching horseshoes and swimming in a pool, and bikes lined up and down the driveway. You know, these are my peeps, my people, man. So I'm digging in the garbage can looking for the Budweisers and stuff, you know. And they asked me what I was doing. I told them, he goes, you ain't going to find that here. It's an AA picnic, Kenny. I go, can I use your bathroom? You know, to the guy that was owned the place. And he goes, yeah, go ahead. First thing I did was open up his medicine chest, looking for the Valiums, the barbiturates, anything, you know. And he had some kids' aspirin. That's about it in there, you know. Toothpaste, shaving lotion. And man, and I couldn't believe it. But that was the attraction to me. This guy that was just like me was clean for a year. And it was beyond anything I could believe in. You know. I go, tell me how you did it. I got to know. Now, it took 4 more months. You know, I'd come to meetings. They were taking me to meetings, and my beer bottle would be behind their tire of their pickup truck, and they'd leave the meeting before me and run it over, and I'd be pissed off, man. But that's how it was for me. You know, I just kept coming back. I kept listening. And here I am today. I've got friends that will do anything for me, and I would do anything for them. And the only friends I have are the people in these rooms. I keep in contact with our friend from New Jersey after several years, you know, Christmas cards at least, but usually we talk. And I don't know what else to say, man. It's just that this program, this fellowship, grace of my higher power, has kept me alive. You know, for me to be here tonight and tell you my story, it's a blessing, and I'm honored and privileged to do it, and I appreciate you all listening. Thanks a lot.
WJ, Jinkuya. Translation of that is, damn, brother, glad you're in recovery. So, thanks very much, Kenny. I appreciate it. And I know our prayers will be with Jimmy, his son, as he heads over to the Middle East. We're with him. So, and also, I want to say it's just obvious and amazing about this program. No matter where we were, what we did, except that the path has brought us here. We're all here tonight, and that the power and love of this is really amazing. So, again, thank you.